implication of that is that there's a basic education visit to Malanga, where two or three of this members of this committee has been affected. I surely know Ms. Kabai has requested that she needs to do some oversight and I was the chair of basic education. Also, there is a service delivery assessment committee in Parliament, and some of our members is also on that particular committee. It's a party political team that's been sent to the now that means section to the committee. Our apologies to them before. So that we didn't know. But I think it's precisely because of that change, not as of the change in sudden. Then also we've received an apology with again coming from my side, from our honorable rector. Because the agenda of this particular meeting posed the reform, and then in particular to zoom in on reflection on the issue that our rector had to deal with. And really the request via notification to me was that if we are able to somehow the process, the litigation process is taking place as we speak in the next 2-3 weeks. And the request was if we are able just to delay, because some of that can impact in one way or another. And I felt to again, and I'm saying to again, give approval for that request. Because it's coming from we've made the request for the rector to come and give a analysis and explain the rationale and also the engagement that this committee has seen in the public domain between the minister, the director general, and the rector, Janssen. We felt it important that we also get appreciation. However, that is still evading us, and I would request my committee, I didn't first consult the committee to get approval if that's accepted, that we delay it for another time, but I felt the request was reasonable, even though it's coming now for 2 or 3 months. So let me put that there. And indicate to the committee members, I'll allow the committee to, if they want to raise anything, before we get into the agenda. But this agenda item, therefore, is a briefing. I've requested Ms. Kelsey just to reflect on, before we get to the actual briefing of here, so that's just that context, and then to deal with it, after them, to deal with the draft annual report, and just a minute, a point out of the last minutes about the capitation to this committee, which we discussed last week. But is there members that want to respond on the initial points that I've raised before we get into the agenda item? If not, then we can proceed. Let me therefore welcome our visitors from our education from Africa. Clearly they brought a very strong team. It's a strategy of intimidation, but our committee members will try and keep up to the plate. But really thank you for bringing a very solid to present the issue under discussion. I surely believe it's precisely because of the importance and the significance of this item. We know that there was incidents in South Africa around coherent and disintegration at times around that social cohesion. That we've seen both in society at large, but we've also seen it in particular institutions and institutions of violence. And the process the minister has pronounced himself on, the recommendations and the findings that came out of that report. And on the 10th, somewhere last year, in fact, he then identified the recommendations to be reflected on by ESA. That was middle last year. Ms. Kempsey, if you, as a representative of the department, also just introduce yourself again to some of our observers. And if you would want to just that process and the recommendations and how the department is taking on it and then we can get from it.
Good morning, Chairperson. My name is Kirsty Menon. I'm the acting DDG for the university's branch in the Department of Higher Education and Training. Thank you for this opportunity. The Sedin report was released in June last year by the minister. Following the report, which emanated from the rapes incident at the University of Free State, and extended to all 23 of our institutions to understand the extent to which racism is present on our campuses, the extent to which transformation initiatives are taking place, and the extent to which policies and reforms are actually materializing on our campuses. Following the release of the report, the minister wrote to the chairs of council of our universities, vice chancellors, our stakeholder bodies like the Council on Higher Education, HESA, and the instruction was quite clear that the report should be studied, that the recommendations which extended from structural problems with the entire sector, systemic problems, policy issues within particular institutions, and the students' lived experiences at our institutions all required debate and discussion within our institutions. The minister also asked institutions to widely disseminate the report, provide a forum for debate and discussion within the institution, formulate a response, and revert to the minister by the 29th of January of this year. This matter has subsequently been raised by the minister with meetings with HESA, with the CHE, what we have received at the moment are 6 responses from our 23 institutions. Some institutions have asked for an extension so that it can be tabled at their appropriate governance structures prior to being sent to our offices. And we are in the process of following up with those who haven't responded. It's Rhodes University, BITS University, UKZN, and I have to check with the other 3 because they just came in yesterday. I don't have the...
Can we then ask the department to verify that and possibly by SMS or quickly making a call so that we can have that? Because this is of utmost importance. And if by the 23rd of February we still did not receive the complete majority of the institution's feedback responses, the question that I'm asking is what importance are being given at the university to this matter. We as a committee, we went to the University of Stellenbosch. One of the items that we picked up is that currently, this is now 6 months ago, that approximately 4% of the staff complement actually we've seen transformation. And the intention is to, by 2050, to reach 15%. That's one example. Since 1994 to 2015, to have the intention to reach 15%, it is a major concern. Another point that's being raised then by that particular institution was that it's difficult to attract black professionals in that particular meeting. The question that I posed is, what is the culture that black professionals enter to make it appropriate for them to function in that space? Now, that's all to do with the analysis around this particular report. It raised the report with a very solid review, has gone into a lot of detail at different institutions and picked up some of those things and the generic issues. It's therefore fundamentally a problem for me if the majority of our institutions, and in particular institutions where this is an issue, is not responding. So if we can find out, so I don't want to throw that, I'm making a judgment that it's the majority of the institutions, possibly everyone has submitted in the last 3 days and we don't have it. So let's quickly hear from the department as of today. I think it is, there's in fact letters that was written subsequent to one or two of our visits to amongst others, the University of Stellenbosch. When parents wrote here and said they are appreciating the fact that the committee went and they've now made contact, and when we saw the letters of students being turned away, we just couldn't understand it. When we then engaged the rector, immediately the issue was resolved. So the problem is, it cannot be because of special interventions, because of either a minister, a committee, or a committee chair, or a rector, to ensure that we see enhancement in terms of our gender and empowering our students to enter. Because that intervention that you can really only deal for individuals that got the capability and the capacity and really the willpower to put the issue on paper and then to follow it up beyond a institution. So this is a particular concern. To the department, we want to say that I think we would want whatever the deadlines that the ministry and the director general identify, but we have to have a full report on this matter in 2 weeks time from now. But today, in the next hour, so we will know which is the institutions that have not submitted. So we want the list of those that submitted and the list of those that have not. For that, I would want to hand over to Esa. The question to you is, what are you doing? The question is, in what way are we therefore responding to the review process and acting? So the reason why I've asked that contextual brief is to remind us where we came from. I'm asking committee members to assess if we didn't yet see this, in terms of, I'm saying the presentation, we've seen it up front before the time. But as you present, I'm calling on the committee members to say, is this responding on the issue that we know is of importance? Meaning, are we believing that yes, it's giving the importance to this matter as they're supposed to, or is the issue that we want to raise? So look at it very critically. Before that, in the draw.
Chairperson, you just said that when you visited one of the institutions of higher learning, the students were being sent back, and immediately when you intervened, then the problem was immediately resolved. I'm interested to know the reasons which were given for retaining the students, because I don't think the university, they've just returned the students without having a tangible reasons for that. Now, if it really creates a problem, if on intervention immediately they are accepted, it's like there was no base for retaining the students. Thank you.
So just on a separate matter, one of the things that needs emphasizing is the fact that the portfolio committee, like all other portfolio committees, holds government to account. And therefore, our perspective, certainly from where I sit, is that what part of our job is to make sure that the government does its job properly in supporting universities. And that's a very crucial area to keep in mind.
You then would be able to even respond to that as we continue. I'll just take the one example, because I don't want to belabor the point, Honorable Bonomo. After our visit, 2 weeks after our visit, because remember it was nationally televised and in the papers, after our visit to Stellenbosch University, we got a letter from a lady that says, or a father that says, look, we were quite energized by the fact that we now can actually get, even if that the university is also saying that the language will not be an excuse for allowing people in, right? Or not allowing people. Meaning if you speak English and you then go and apply to University of Stellenbosch, you will not be left out of the process of getting into the university because your first language is English. Then this particular, after our national televised and the responses of the university, responses of the minister, and this is all documented, I think we've got all copies of it because the secretary has to deal with the details. The father then called the student point where the registration took place. The person that side, and we've got all the information, the person that side answers and says, look, if your child, if the student is English speaking, it's possibly not best for the person to study here because it will be difficult. Now remember, that's the response. As you make your call for student acceptance, that's the response then that you get. Now, if it was not a father that pursued this matter, in a sense, it is a demotivation immediately. When I looked at the student or the matriculant and a pastor, she was like, she's got eight right through, three or four. It wasn't post the results, but it was middle year results, etc. So I couldn't understand how it's not possible. And when we followed it up, immediately it's been corrected. So it was not necessarily even possibly the policy. It was in its implementation. It was the culture. It was the way a person at a particular important desk responded. Now, that's a father that has gone through, he was an orphan, he's gone through suffering, he's made it as a doctor, and therefore he's got the ability to push. And that's why he's pushed right up to ourselves. But it's an individual situation. How much thousands can't do that push? And I think that's what's the issue. And there's other examples, but these are very real examples that I've given. So it's a systemic issue and a way of operation that it becomes a concern. And I think that is what you obviously have to confront with. So over to the presenters of this. And if you can also just introduce your collective.
Thank you, Chair Patterson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much for your opening remarks, and we've been listening very carefully. We also have heard about the report from the department. But let me do the first. My name is Errol Chobega, and I'm here in my capacity as the chairperson of ESA, but I'm the principal of Pune University of Technology. I'll ask the members of my delegation also to introduce themselves.
I'm Erin Moklana. I'm here in my capacity as deputy chair for HIPAA, but at the same time also serving as the vice chancellor and principal of the Vale University of Technology.
My name is Gordon Vire. I'm the deputy vice chancellor at the Vale University of Technology, but I'm here in my capacity as the chairperson of the Transformation Manager Forum under the auspices of HIPAA.
Good morning, I'm Pani Pijana. I'm here in my capacity as the chair of the Transformation Strategy Group of HISA and Vice Chancellor of UNISA.
Hello,
that completes our delegation. I believe that Dr. Meg Price, one of our EXCO members in HISA, will be joining us later with a point to recognize. We're grateful that we've been invited to this session where we're going to share or exchange ideas on one of the complex issues, one of the really challenging issues not only for higher education, but for the country as a whole. And therefore, I want to start by saying that we're not going to discuss the perfect system yet, but what we're coming to say is that there's work that's going on within higher education, and like any other sector, we're faced with certain challenges that we're trying to deal with, and indeed, some of these we'll share with you this morning. But what we intend to do, basically, I'll kick off by giving a background, and that will be followed by one of the challenging issues. Just within the sector, we're debating what transformation. And we need, when we begin to act on that we've got some shared understanding. And therefore, Prof. Pijane will lead us on that discussion. Thereafter, I'll ask Prof. Vire to talk to some of the issues of how are we really beginning to respond to the minister's response. So let me just kick off by, this is the outline of our presentation, and at the end of it all, we'll take questions, we'll have that discussion. Perhaps it's particularly important that one starts by saying that as HISA, we are a voluntary organization. And a voluntary organization that represents the public subsector of higher education in the country. We also want to say that we are an independent body constituting the 23 public higher education institutions, and all of them are members of HISA. The board of HISA, or the directors of the board, are actually the vice chancellors of the various institutions. We have, as part of our executive leg, our HISA office, which is led by Professor Malaza, our CEO, and that office has a staffing of about 40 members. Indeed, the intention of that office is really to design, plan, and implement programs and projects of HISA. And this is partly to advance the interests of higher education. So that's our mandate and really role. And therefore, one needs to say, once we talk collectively, but it gets very difficult for us to account here for the individual institution. I need to say that perhaps even some of the issues that the chair kind of mentioned, but we need to put them into context. If we were to look at the National Senior Certificate Exam, the outcome of that process, I know it's been something that has been discussed extensively, the outcome of that process is that 334,000 students were eligible for admission into higher education. Now, the public higher education institutions have the capacity to absorb about 100,000 of those students. The 23 institutions have the capacity to absorb only 100,000 of the first entry students.
No, but are you saying up to
9? Out of 334,000 students. Those students qualified in entry for certificates, for diplomas, as well as bachelors. That's the total. Qualify for with minimum requirements for certificate, diplomas, and bachelor. So the higher education, public higher education, can we get it straight that 23 public universities, they service certificate, diplomas, and bachelor. So you can see that universities are not able to absorb 2/3 of those students. And therefore, we want to emphasize the fact that competition is high for entry.
Can we
clarify this point? This is a very important point. Let's take the certificate. I mean, it's certificate, diplomas, degrees.
And now, the bottom line is, in practice, for example, this is a question straight to yourself rather, not Mr. Chesa. There was roughly 350,000 students, learners that actually matriculated. Am I right? Of that 350,000, how many, for example, would, in terms of their certification, get university access in terms of, because I'm hearing your professor talking about that same number. That's not my understanding. Just remember your figures that we've asked you a while ago. And this is important because the reason why is otherwise we assume certain things. Because the sample for me is actually not that big in terms of the 350,000.
Can I give you the approximate numbers? I think there has to be an understanding here that the way universities are made up, we have traditional universities, which the bulk of the students will go into degrees. Then we have comprehensive universities. Comprehensive universities will train both from a certificate all the way up to degrees. Then we've got universities of technology, which will train largely at a certificate level as well as diploma level, and to a small extent, degree level. And so that's our architecture. Now, in terms of numbers, students who qualify for bachelor's degree were just above 100,000. Now, those who qualified for diplomas were about 132,000. And those for certificates were just over 100,000. So those are the statistics. So the system as a whole has to look at the whole spectrum.
Yeah.
And in practice, before even we look at the certificate, that not even diplomas, the certificate, the bulk of
of your students, therefore, even just at the level of the degree, that 23 universities, in fact, would even struggle to get 10. That's why I'm saying I don't even want to go to your 300.
Absolutely.
Because then we're making certain serious assumptions here. Meaning, all the matriculants that have passed will be able to get some form of post-school opportunity. But the moment that they even apply to any university, whether it's technology, whether it's University of Technology, or, for example, the historical traditional universities on this degree, not even 100,000 of that 300,000 would be able to be accommodated. And the people that for sure will not be accommodated, the bulk of them is those that would have certificate exemption in the sense. I thought that's important, otherwise there's an assumption about 340,000 plus that can, and because of the pressure, we are not able to accommodate that. I'm saying the pool is even smaller. The reality is that pool is even smaller. Because everyone that with a matric certificate, in a sense, then as you categorize it appropriately, have an opportunity beyond. But the reality is, in practice, it doesn't happen that way. Not even at the level of sounds diploma, that they've got that, or that they can actually study degree. The only reason why that's triggered, it was an interesting debate between two chairpersons, basic education and higher education, and then late at night, on a Saturday night at 11 o'clock. So I really wanted to clarify this point.
You're absolutely right. I mean, we know what the dilemma is, right? The only way we can grow human resources is by including more and more black talented students. That's actually what the dilemma is. So we have to grow that, and we have to grow that with schooling. The point about 100,000 places at universities already claims universities. You must understand that.
Yeah, that's the point.
Because we know success at university partly depends on formal lectures, but it more often depends on having small tutorial groups and a whole range of other environmental factors that would make learning possible at universities. The major issue has to do with finance. You know, you need more lecture halls and more university residences in order to absorb black students. And that costs money, and that's not in the budget. So, I mean, we will speak in very concrete detail around this because the money, finance aspect is important. But in the president did not mention universities in his address. It was FET colleges is an important sector. And in the budget itself, we'll see there's a 13% increase. And then there's some capital expenditures which are set aside. But essentially to grow to the point where universities would increase the gross participation rate of our society, even in terms of government's own goal of 20%. But let's set Chile's or the Caribbean's goal of 35%. You're going to need an enormous amount of investment in higher education. And I don't see the plan for it. So that's a very important issue I've identified.
Yeah, that's exactly why I'm zooming into it, because the bottom line is there is struggling learners getting from Integrate 1 and actually make it to grade 12. And guess what? After grade 12, when they start to apply, they wouldn't be able to because there's other pressures. Now, I'm saying it's not there. They've done what they had to do. It is therefore the institutions of the state that, in fact, have to make sure that we are able to find those opportunities and mechanisms. So we are saying that the sample is even smaller in real terms. I just wanted to zoom in. I hope you understand what the issue of the content. Sorry for this. Okay, fine.
Just also indicate that this sample actually has to be looked at disaggregated, because one has to talk about the subjects that qualify one for entrance into particular programs. And that's quite an important point to be made.
You understand, meaning you can't speak about 300,000 and something. That's essentially the point here for that's eligible for university access, even if at the level of certification because it depends on the actual subject. Professor, over to you.
Thank you very much. I will not respond to anything. I'll go through the presentation. Thank you. Well, the first point we're making is that one of the challenges we're facing is trying to work towards achieving 20% participation. And this is a daunting challenge because, we've managed just a 1% increase since the beginning of this millennium. So there's a daunting challenge. We're sitting at 16% at the moment. The second challenge we're seeing is the area of study, and we're having enormous challenges with regards to science, engineering, and technology, which has remained at about 20 to 28% throughout. And therefore, this is something where we need to really put in a lot of effort. We, however, encourage that there has been an increase in business and management. On the other hand, we still have an excess graduates in human and social sciences. So that's a positive thing, but we're not getting our statistics correct. But I think what is worrying about our system is graduation rates, which are skewed in favor of white and Indian students, while more African and colored students, whilst we know that they've gained access, but in terms of graduation rates, these are lagging behind quite a lot. But I think one of the challenges we need to begin to address aggressively is really meeting needs for at high level for professional and research skills, the whole area of high level skills and creation of knowledge. But this morning we're talking to the issue of transformation, and that remains something high on the agenda of institutions. Yes, when the draft report came out in June, and probably the final report in November, this is how CISA responded to it. Firstly, CISA welcomed the ministerial report, and we think it's an important document, and it has to be a living document. I think for us, as CISA, the report provides us a platform to debate and engage on issues of transformation. I think that's vital. But at the same time, it gives us an opportunity to look at where are we going as a sector in relation to transformation. But at the same time, to look back and say, since 1994, what has occurred? Have we made any strides in this journey? It does also act as a mirror for us where we can view our achievements as well as see weaknesses. And therefore, if you, as learning organizations, universities, find this a useful exercise. But for HISA, it also gives us an opportunity for creating a common approach and an action plan in order to deal with these daunting challenges thrown to us by transformation. We, however, want to say that individual institutions, their own implementation of the 40 recommendations that are in the report, the implementation is quite uneven. This is one thing we want to concede. And this has to do also with the historical context from which these institutions evolve. Let me just conclude by saying that what is our sector's approach to transformation? I think in order for us to deal with that, I'm going to hand over to Professor Peter, who's going to lead this section that deals with our sector approach.
Professor, can you just park there so that we can just hear if
comments from our members on that presentation, that part. Understanding is part of the bigger piece. Also, I think the member has joined now. So can you introduce yourself, Dr.? Thank you. We've actually got the apology initially. So members, what I would want to do, there were certain things that the professor, the chairperson, indicated. If there's any questions related to that, let's deal with it. This is also obviously the way we position our committee is for engagement, correct, as we said. So this is not just narrow clinical questions and answers.
Thank you, Chair. Professor, I'm Dr. Jobeka, just in my mind, I need to hear something. Last year, FIFA presented, there was a report that was suggesting that first-year students or learners were unable to read nor write English and all of that, right? So which means that there would therefore be, not that I would wish to see that, but surely there must be a high failure rate in first year. So the 100,000 that should get into universities, the three of them, it is in addition to the ones that are already there that did not pull through to the second year. This is what I want to understand, that it's more cramped than just the 100,000 that you're unable to absorb, because there is a holding issue with reference to first-year students. So I just wondered, because that takes a big chunk of university, you know, as we speak.
We'll get the responses to Member Bunyama.
Thank you, Chairperson. To me, the most worrying factor is to learn that the intake of new students is very, very low. And this is a serious problem if we want to actually improve human resources in this country. We need people who have gone through universities and technicals. And if children who pass matric, just a few of them can access universities, then it's a problem that needs solutions. And I want to get from Professor Jobeka as to what, not only him, but also the other members of the delegates, what is it that they think should actually be done in order to improve the intake of new students at these institutions of learning. Thank you.
Thank you. I think I've been partly covered by the two questions, but I just want to add my concern around the student graduation rate that is, has been mentioned here. As to say, really, if we can say what are the factors of that, is if we are happy to say the access of our African and colored students, they do have access to these institutions, but it's a worrying factor if you see them, a few of them being able to complete, to graduate at the end. So as to say, maybe after the meeting, in this meeting, we can see those factors and see how do we connect with even the basic education, how do we prepare them, these African learners, for them when they reach this high institution to perform more, so that you can see quite a number of them being able to complete and graduate once they gain access to this high institution. Thank you.
The last person, Member Khadega.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to get a clarity here that the graduate that you just, or challenges that you also envisage, is that your science, engineering, technology students, they haven't managed to reach the target that is expected. Knowing that we've got shortage of skills in South Africa, and you're also having this challenge, have you tried to come up with other means of strategies to resolve such kind of challenge, because it's a very serious challenge. We can't just celebrate to say we haven't reached the target, but at least we have something. It can't be like that. We must be able to come up with solutions in terms of these challenges. Because we can't always, as South Africa, import skills, whereas we've got our high institutions that can be able to also produce these skills. But also, I just want to just check something here. What is the reason of you going to debate transformation? Has anyone need to debate transformation? I mean, it has been said, and it's something that has been known. A transformation must be implemented. There's only to debate transformation. You must implement transformation. Because at the end of the day, you're supposed to give us results. Because each and every time only debate, you prolong time. And only for a long time, you know, the president was just saying, this is the year of action. You must be able to produce a come up with positive results rather than sitting down, having engagement, all these debates, prolonging time. Because at the end of the day, we won't be able to see the end result. Thank you.
Let's get the response. If you, in your response, you can also just mention about why the proportion, and I know the general response, but I just want to hear from Esa. Why the proportion of students enrolled in FET cases is low?
Thank you very much. Quite a number of questions. I'll just give one or two responses, and I hope my colleagues will join in. Why debate instead of implementation? I've no doubt that when you debate, you begin to understand concepts much better, but that doesn't mean that one shouldn't begin to implement. So debate doesn't, and implementation are not exclusive. And probably as we go through our talk, we'll indicate some of the things we're beginning to do. I think all the questions that have been asked really, they point to serious situation our country finds itself. It's our school education. I think there needs to be a much greater effort to ensure improvement of our school education. And probably at other settings that matter gets debated a lot, and we shouldn't try and go through that. The teachers, in fact, involvement of parents as well as ensuring that we do have teachers that can really teach math and science and technology. So these are the challenges facing our country. And there are things that are being done. I mean, there are a lot of programs now through Funda Vishaka that are supporting the training of teachers in math, science and technology. So we are making not as much strides as one would like to see, but there are some good beginnings. I want to say that unless you've got a broad base from your high school of students with mathematics, with physical sciences, and good language, which most of the institutions are using English as the medium of instruction. Unless we get those right, we're not going to get some of the issues that we're taking right. So that's an enormous challenge, and all of us, we need to work at it very hard in order to find solutions.
Thanks, Chair. I think there's a useful metaphor that is quite useful to think about when you think about higher education. You need to look at it in the whole context of schooling, applying from preschooling, early childhood learning, through a school system to higher education. Most of the symptoms that the problems we're looking at higher education are a symptom of things that cannot only be fixed at higher education level only. Also, if you look at the post-school system, it's very small. The university sector is small, but also the vocational sector is small as well. And the problem needs then to be looked at within that much broader context.
Thank you.
Let's make one admission to ourselves. Much as you say that by the time our children reach university, so much damage has been done. But there is definitely an inextricable link between the unqualified, the underqualifiedness of our teachers. And this definitely has an impact upon the preparedness level of our students, particularly in science, math, and so forth. And that link is just there. So we want to go further down in order to rectify that. Money.
Can I, before we then proceed to Professor Pagiana, I knew this is going to go to this point, and I'm not accepting the response. I'll tell you why. Actually, this is essentially what we are seeing in front of us here, is possibly the best possible brain in its collectivity. And it tells us that, because the reality is what you're sketching out. That's the problem statement, but we all know the problem statement. And therefore, if that is the problem statement, and if we actually analyze that problem statement in the context of how we've analyzed it the last 5 years, what are we saying to the next 20 years? What are we saying? Because we're essentially saying this thing is so difficult to fix because we have to wait for that pipeline, which is completely right. We understand the problem statement, the analysis, and the long-term intervention. What I find amiss is the innovation. Not necessarily in this forum. I'm raising it because I've raised it with NSFAS as well. I've raised it with the department. What I find amiss is this amazing innovation of experts that you've got in the education arena in South Africa, not able to resolve this particular issue. Now I'm going to give you one practical example. One practical example. We know that there's a pipeline. But if we do today, not in 10 years' time, not in 5 years' time, not in 2 years' time, if we do today, a scan in every university, in every province, and now let's take the four poorest provinces, of university students on scarce skills, that's why I posed the question around SET. Of university students that were eligible, or people that were eligible to go to university, and in fact they were allowed entrance at university. But guess what? Because of the conditions the last 20 to 30 years, in the household, etc., they had to drop off first year or second year, meaning there's not an issue of entrance because they've got that certificate that says they can go to university. By the way, possibly most of them then went to university. And if you take them as a cohort and you put all the capacity that's possible behind them, there is just no way that we can. So I believe whilst we are speaking the problem that the pipeline needs to deliver and the problem of teachers, if we are just able to scan the whole country, we'll possibly be able to pick up 2,000 at least clerks somewhere at a school, a cashier at Pick a Pay, a brilliant cashier. But my dream wasn't realized because my father died and I had to look after the kids and I had to drop out of school, of university. But I've got the university access. So you can easily, once again, take 2,000 or 3,000 and pull them into a cohort and run with it. And NSFAS, the department, and ESA, and the universities need to pull. That's one example. You see, I think we've got this phenomena of the starfish, which is right possibly 30 years ago. If we can help with the one individual, it's going to be impacting. Guess what? There's 2.7 million only between 18, 16 and 24, unemployed and unemployable, but even larger in that category up to 35. And we are seeing them on the street. Another example is one where we've actually, and I think, I don't know, Dr. Price, there's this program that I flipped into a suggestion with ESA, not with ESA, with NSFAS in fact, which we've given an example. We've taken engineering students, an architect and quantitative analyst, quantity survey students. We've taken 4 universities in this province. And we've pulled, and they were most disadvantaged students. And we've put, now the average pass rate at university for disadvantaged students is 35 to 40% for engineering students. Right? The national average pass rate. That particular program was 75 to 80% pass rate, throughput rate. Different? It's not, that's not even innovation. It's just us pulling together. So the reality is, how do we pull together as this education cluster? We're not saying when we engage, when Member Khadeva asked a very pertinent question, we're not saying it's here before. So it's not an issue of that. It's an issue of how do all these brains are diagnosing the problem every time. But we are not able to put immediate steps in place. Because if we have to wait for this problem at pre-primary, primary, high school, to continue, we can actually say, let's quickly dump the next 20 years and then, for example, hope that after 20 years, now what is that? That's the problem. So I'm raising that in the context that what we are looking for is, as higher education, as the department and others are brilliant in research initiatives in this country, why can't we be as brilliant in innovation when it comes to just trying to have a pull up of black students throughput at university? And that's the issue that I'm looking at. Over on that note, Professor Pachani, over to you.
Honorable Chair and honorable members of the Portfolio Committee, Chairperson of FISA and colleagues, thank you very much. My presentation really will be brief and takes off from where Professor Chubeka left off. It is important, however, to say that there are two major issues that are important in understanding HISA's approach to transformation. The first is to recognize that HISA's approach is born out of the consciousness and commitment to the values set out in our Constitution and reflected in the Higher Education Act and in the White Paper for Higher Education, number 3. Secondly, it is important also to for us to understand as a result of that constitution, higher education institutions, for them, institutional autonomy is an important as well. In approaching issue, HISA and all higher education institutions have been consistently involved in transformation, so the language of transformation has been there. And by and large, there's been a lot of achievements that have been made. The number of admissions and students in higher education has changed, reversed in many respects on black male and female higher education institutions in our country in the last 15 years. By and large, there's been black academics at some level coming into higher education institutions. But at the same time, as we say that, we're also conscious of the major challenges that we face, in particular in nurturing and growing and developing and retaining black and women academics to remain in the higher education sector. So some of them are sitting next to me and are now members of parliament. That is the measure of the hemorrhaging out of higher education that we are having to contend with. When the challenges and the issues that were raised at the University of the Free State. The first thing that HISA did was to have adverts immediately after that a major discussion of the board of directors of HISA. As a result of that discussion, it was decided to establish a transformation strategy group for HISA. And I was asked to chair that transformation strategy group. almost at the same time, either the same day or the following day, the then Minister of Education announced a ministerial task team that she had established to deal with transformation in higher education. We resolved at that point that we will continue with the process that HISA had established alongside and support the ministerial task team that had been declared. And as far as we understand, all higher education institutions gave every support possible to the Sudan process. The work of the task team, however, took a slightly different turn. It became very important to us to really begin to analyze and understand exactly what is the nature of the challenge that higher education institutions are facing. We were very much aware of the insidious nature and the prevalence of racism in our institution, subliminal and otherwise. We were very much aware that the language in higher education probably had over time lent itself to a lessening of consciousness to issues of racism in many of our institutions. We became aware that we needed to restore and try to find a nuanced way of understanding higher education. Because for far too long, we'd seen transformation as a way of having senior executives withdrawn, and rightly so, from the historically disadvantaged communities. And we'd seen as important the admission of students from historically disadvantaged institutions. We were battling with the issue of bringing from historically disadvantaged groups to bring in into the academic sector, especially at entrance level and moving them to the higher levels of the professoriate and elsewhere, and that those challenges remained because of the nature of universities over a very long time. We became aware that the big challenge most universities needed to attend to, and by and large was not attended to, was the problem of the institutional culture and environment in many of our institutions. We were very conscious that part of that institutional culture was part of the manner in which our transformation in this country came about, where so much of what we received in the past, we moved into the future. And the reality of the environment, the alienating environment, which in some respects was there in the institution, the practices that were referred to elsewhere, the initiation practices and the cultures that had been there, there was a sense in which this simply just moved into the different environment with a changed character of the student body that was there. And yet they were part of the institution, but they were not part of the institution in the sense that there were a very different brand of students that were in place who were probably more sensitive about some of these practices. So we became aware that the institutional cultures at our universities was a major, major problem that needed to be addressed. It needed to be understood and analyzed and see what does it take to actually change, in many instances, the whole history of our institutions. The second issue that is related to that, that is worth drawing attention to, is that actually the geography of our higher education institutions has barely changed, not even with the rationalization that took place with the mergers. There are still black universities and all that goes with it. And there are still traditionally white universities and all that goes with it, even if there are more students now, maybe some black academics. But the character of the institutions actually has hardly changed. So we needed to understand that phenomenon, because transformation is more than just bringing more black people, more women. It's more than just changing some of the issues that we've been talking about. We need a much more nuanced understanding. Many of our institutions, I think almost all of them, dutifully report on employment equity to the Department of Labor. and the equity policies in the institutions are very much in place. And that led us to really beginning to say, at heart, besides the institutional culture and environment, is also something that many of our institutions have hardly begun to engage to any serious extent. It is about whether the learning environment or the learning culture in our institutions, the issues around indigenous knowledge, more than just curriculum, it is about ways of knowing, ways of learning, ways of understanding knowledge cultures or cultures of knowledge in our institutions, whether sufficient of those have been impacted upon by the new environment in the new South Africa. All of that suggested to us, and let me just pause, Honorable Chair, and say, our understanding, first, is that the Sudin report, it's important to underline, is not a report of HISA. It is a report of the committee to the Minister for Education and Training. As HISA, we have not influenced that report at all. And maybe if we had, we were more than just research subjects, because I think we were research subjects much more than participants. If we'd been much more than just research subjects in the Sudin report, we might actually have reflected this differently. The minister at the time, I think rightly, took the view that it would be inappropriate for the higher education institutions, universities as such, to be part of the debate, of the investigation, if you like. Because if you take the view that you are the ones who are being investigated, how can you investigate yourself? We didn't think that we were being investigated. We think that, I personally think, all of us have got a common concern that we need to work with and find solutions to. So it is important to say that we are not claiming the Sudin report to be a report that we have appropriated or are saying that we agree with in every respect. But as the chair of HISA has said, we see the Sudin report as an important statement about our institutions that we have to engage. And it is an opportunity for serious engagement, and that is what has happened. Having sketched what for us is a importance of transformation understood in a much more nuanced and deeper level and deeper way, it became clear to us that we needed two approaches. One was an investigative environment, a research environment ourselves, that would really get into the depths of what is happening in our higher education institutions, and find ways in an intellectual sort of way, find ways of addressing what we think are deep-seated issues in our institutions beyond just the superficial that actually happens. The second thing is that we recognize that we needed to have a transformation managers forum established within HISA to really bring transformation managers from all higher education institutions together and to work within the context of HISA to become the drivers and sharing of expertise and resources in higher education as a whole. Thirdly, we recognize that and some of the challenges, as we've just said, is that HISA represents the public higher education institutions, and for the reasons given, the issues around enrollments and all of that, we are at the same time working within a regulatory environment that government sets in place. The enrollment plans, for example, do set very clear limits and targets for admission. So as a matter of fact, higher education institutions are not wholly at liberty about who, within the framework that has been set, they could accept. But we want to say that within that whole regulatory environment, there are certain key matters of principle, approaches of principle, that are important for us, that are important to shape the way we understand and we affirm transformation. The result, of course, Chair, of all of these is that from the Sudin report, all institutions were requested to submit their responses to HISA. As of the last count, there were about 12 institutions that had in fact submitted their responses. In addition to that, HISA has appointed a researcher to analyze all the responses that we have in the light of the policy that I've just set out, the insight that I've just set out from the way we understand transformation. We are awaiting that finalization of that report to establish a HISA standpoint as such. But we do think that the higher education sector as a whole is being presented with a historic challenge and opportunity to really begin, if I may say so, for the first time since 1994, to move beyond the ghosts of the past, if you like, and begin to construct a new higher education system for a new South Africa. And that is the opportunity that we had, but in many respects, it may be easier said than done, but it is the extent of the challenge that, if I may say so, we all face in our country. Thank you.
What would be the next presentation so that I then allow first questions to...
Well, the next one is kind of leave some of the things that we're doing in response to the report.
Okay, that's fine. So then that will be the third one, just before that. We've got 6 and we've got 12. What is the correct one?
I've got the updated list from the department. We have the submission of BITS, RHODES, UK Sudan, CUT, CPUT, UWC, UJ, and a request for an extension of date from UCT. That is 7 in, 1 arrived this morning, and 1 request for an extension.
Do you want to respond?
Just to explain that, these are two different processes.
Can we get just the list quickly to all those that have submitted and those that didn't submit, just quickly to Anneli, please. In response to Professor.
I wanted to just focus on one aspect of transformation and just hear your response to it. And that has to do with the system of administrative justice at universities. Say there is a student at a particular campus who feels aggrieved that an act of racism has been committed against him or her. Does the university have the machinery to deal with it properly by due process so that it's resolved? And it's a question one would ask of all universities. Has that been measured? See, it wasn't measured in the SOTIM report. So that, I think I wanted to ask that question. But not just racism, also at the University of Limpopo, if a isiZulu speaker feels aggrieved because of the ethnic nature of exclusion, for example, on some particular issue, is there machinery to deal with that as well?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Professor Pichana. One is probably a comment, and then I'll ask the question. I think that somewhere, I'm feeling that there are two voices. There's the Sudan report, and then there's HISA. there are two voices. How do we find one voice? Because up until we find that one voice, can we know what we're doing? So I'm putting it out there. And then, it being a presentation of academics, I see that the approach to transformation is all the things that you say, Professor Pichan. So in a sense, in my mind, there's a sense that I think HISA, and probably rightfully so, is trying to be many things to many people. And for me, I think that we have really used and abused the word transformation to a point where I do not understand what transformation means. I do not understand what you are transforming and what you are transforming for, because I do not know. So for me, I think that we need the articulation of this problem of transformation. If there was a need in 1994 to transform, are we transforming as per the 1994 need, or has the transformation evolved? Have we segmented transformation outputs? That we would have said the first 5 years would have been a transformation output A, and from which we then evolve into the next and the next. So it's a huge element. Of course, what is going on in higher education is a microcosm of what is going on in society. So it cannot just take higher education to fix the problems of society at large. But for me, I just need us to just say that what is that single most important transformation output that we as higher education, we can relentlessly and single-mindedly follow that output and say we have at least this one.
Honourable Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much. I think to those two very, very important points that were made, I think to the first one, Honourable Member Dr. Wilmot James, is to say that the whole point of getting all those responses from the institution and developing and understanding what happens in the institutions and the commitments that have been made, and drawing an institutional template, if you like, of what institutions are doing is what we are committed to doing and reporting on. Many institutions, and beyond that, I think I can only talk about individual institutions until that is happening. I can say, from our understanding, many institutions have got policies in place to deal with issues of race and gender. Some institutions have got offices of ombudsman to deal with aggrieved students. And there are conditions of employment that also place the issue of race and gender discrimination very much in place. Many of the councils of our universities are very, very conscious of this matter. But I think it is not good enough for me to say what I've just said. At the end of the day, we're going to need to reflect and present a sector position, and that is the purpose of the exercise that we have undertaken. I'd like to believe, Honourable James, that many of our institutions, if there is the complaint, a grievance of the kind that you raise, will actually deal with it, should have the mechanism to deal with it. But I say that in a very cautious way, because I don't know that I can say that very strongly. If I can come to Honourable Member Bogosalinda to say that the approach that she is raising is precisely what we are seeking to say. There is a level at which
at the visible level, maybe. There's a level at which our higher education institutions today are not the same as they were in 1990. That's a fact. But you want to say that it's not good enough to have, as you said, Honorable Chair, to have more black people, to have more than 50% of your students being black people or more than 50% being women in your institution. You also ought to be beginning to raise the bar and ask some further fundamental questions. What are they in the institution to do? Do they succeed in what they wish to do once they get into the institution? Are they able to succeed? Is the dropout rate and the failure rate, and what causes the dropout rate and failure rate of a majority of the black students whom you bring into the system? You need to understand what lies behind students dropping out and what are the support mechanisms in the institutions to support them. You need to understand why it is that fewer and fewer of our students undertake successfully SAT studies in SAT or not. Why are the black students more channeled in certain areas? There's a whole complex issue around that. It's a culture, it's a history. In many respects, the academic environment has a lot to do. That's why I agree with you. I don't think it's good enough for higher education institutions to say it's schools, because it's also about the environment where we are. Because many of the, as you said, Chair, many of the students who have been accepted and, into our universities are probably some of the best performing students in the school system. And they come to higher education and drop. And we need to know why. And the approach that that HISA is taking, rather, is not one that says there are certain pathologies that take place of horrible things here and horrible there. It's to try very hard to get to the substance of what is happening. So I don't really have an immediate answer for the Honourable Member, because I really don't think there are easy answers, ultimately. I do think that it is important to accept the approaches of the two approaches, one from the department and Sudin report, is an important approach because it is an empirical approach. It is about the experiences and the actual experience of people. That's important. And there's one that HISA is driving. There's one that says we must get to the bottom of the character and the nature and the culture and the environment in our institutions. What is it that makes a university a university instead of a tribal community of one kind or another? And these are the challenges. Even those institutions that say they there's an issue around a particular language or another, they have to ask themselves, what does it take to become a real community of scholars, an academic community where different languages interplay, different cultures are at interplay and are affirmed, all of them? That is where we really have to get to as the institution. So I'm saying, the Sudin report is not a HISA report, but we have an approach that I think is different from the Sudin report. The Sudin report has raised some very important critical issues, which as higher education institutions, we are not unaware of because they actually happen in our institutions.
And I just maybe try also highlight the issue about the goals of transformation. That if there are certain goals, members of parliament feel that are not clear. I think there are goals that are from the transformation trajectory of higher education since 1994. The white paper on higher education is very clear on how higher education should be transformed. And the Higher Education Act also is very clear. And we have processes that are within the Department of Higher Education and Training on enrollment planning and program qualification needs, how those are managed. And we have a process of institutional audits that audits institutions, and those include also audits of cultures of institutions. And there are reports that are published made to make recommendations to institutions how to deepen transformation.
So I think they go to RPA and there is a strong regulatory environment. And if you are ready to measure higher education, the transformation, along those policy goals that are set, you'll find that there's been a transformation, as Professor Bijana indicated.
What has already been said covers the points that I am speaking to. Indeed, all my colleagues have touched on the significance of transformation in higher education, and that the Sodin report is indeed a ministerial report, and that higher education itself is the subject of scrutiny in terms of that report. The point that Professor Kijana made earlier on, that of the 23 universities, 12 did submit their responses to HISA. We still have 11 outstanding, and that the HISA Transformation Managers Forum engaged the services of a researcher to collate all those responses in order to put forward a sectoral response. And so the response that we are putting forward to the portfolio committee is just a cursory overview, and it cannot be seen as entirely a sectoral response, because only day after tomorrow, the Transformation Managers Forum will be coming together to interrogate the analytical report that Professor Vincent has been requested to put together, so as to submit the same to the HISA board. HISA board is, of course, our board. We cannot jump over them. So once the HISA board has interrogated that report, I think it will then find its way to the Minister of Office. So I think we just need to have that kind of background before we go into some of the recommendations. Maybe we also need to say that in terms of the recommendations put forward, I think basically there are subsets of the major recommendations, one to the minister and the other one to the higher education. We agree with some of those, we disagree with some, and we want to interrogate others. The first one, for instance, a recommendation to the minister, development of a transformation compact between higher education institutions and the Department of Education. The question here is, what does the ministry understand by development of a compact? Because in terms of the framework documents which are there, like the Higher Education Act, for instance, and the white paper, I think those are in fact facilitating the kind of compact which this report is alluding to. But at the same time, I think Professor Pijana did earlier on mention the Transformation Strategy Group, which he is chairing. And so this group, for instance, to facilitate that kind of compact has not set. And so this is one of the vehicles which the ministry could use in order to engage, you know, much deeper with the sector on issues of transformation. I don't know whether you want me to proceed, Chair. Okay.
Because it's quite a lot of practical implementation detail. I would want you to possibly just do a synopsis and raise some of the critical issues, and even those ones that you in a sense want to engage the department where you possibly feel you're not necessarily coherent on. So kind of a strategic, I think, in line with Professor Tiziana's approach that he kind of gave the perspective.
I think the most important thing that the committee needs to understand, there is no doubt about higher education commitment to transformation. That's one. But the most important one is funding of transformation-specific projects. Because sometimes we talk transformation very broadly. the point that Ms. Ugoza, the Honorable, raised earlier, what we understand by transformation, because the very existence of the Transformation Managers Forum is an attempt to come up with a sectoral understanding of what transformation is all about, given the framework document with which Professor Malaza alluded to. I think that is critical, but if we have to drive transformation seriously, there has to be funding specifically for transformation. Now, I know that the government will say, but we do give you subsidy. We accept that, but there has to be a specific funding. I think that is important. But the second one, Chair, which we need to understand is that we have 23 institutions, and in terms of funding, obviously, they're not getting the same kind of money. So it is critical to look at it. But there is another thing that was mentioned here about strengthening of the institutional forums and then, of course, widening councils. Now, the argument is that not all 23 universities are the same in terms of governance. But if there are institutions where problems of governance have been identified, I think those are the institutions that can be dealt with in terms of strengthening their councils. Because if we simply use broadly, you know, to say that the council membership has got to be expanded as if all institutions have the same problem, I think it really creates a problem. And yet, if there are institutions where specific problems, governance problems have been identified, I think that to us will kind of assist. But of course, the issues of around policies, racism, those are institutional matters. And the institutions do deal with those kinds of issues. And I think it's a general commitment again to those issues. Not unless members of the Parliament Committee would want to pose some questions, and then I think we'll be able to respond to those.
Yeah, I want to advise the members that there is, in the practice, all the actual recommendations and the action suggestions, recommendations and actions, and I think that's effective. So if there's something specifically that any member would want to just pull, and then we can give responses. If not, we also can start with a general response on this point. Let me indicate my uncomfortability. If transformation is linked to, therefore, that the added budget, and I'm picking this up right through these recommendations, we need the money, we need some more money, we need more. The implication is that we therefore can't transform because those money is not there. So in a context where, fortunately, a lot of the money is being pumped into education, but it's also conditional and it's very focused. But does that mean if those money doesn't count, that we actually can't transform? Because in Esther's presentation earlier, I did hear a lot about the cultural, the environment, the way the institution operates. At times, it doesn't actually need money. At times, it needs a repositioning of the way we do business. It reminds me of the expanded public works debate when we talked about it needs additional money. But in a sense, if you build a road, then you possibly can either just get the big contractor or you can actually get a few smaller contractors and put a specialized engineer on top of those smaller ones and just do it a little bit different, meaning it's the way you do it. So I'm concerned about the flow of funding as the issue relating to the transformational question. I'm putting that there as a concern that I'm speaking of. It doesn't mean it's on every action that's there. Before we get the responses, any other member to engage now on either general or the specific?
You've already raised the point, Chair, about what we mean by transformation. For me, it would be taking all measures to ensure that the talent in the country, in fact, gets properly qualified in one degree or the other, and to make a difference on that talent, and especially in the Black African community. So, and if that's what we want to do, then I was really bothered by those. I mean, I know the facts around it, but the graduation rates, when you compare people using apartheid-style categories, white, African, Black, coloured, and Indian. And you'll see that the white and Indian figures are much better than the colored and African figures. If you close your eyes and you ask that question differently, ask it as a class question, break it down by class, you might see quite a different picture.
And then what you then see, if you look at it more closely, is that the households from which working class kids come are not households that are conducive to learning. There are no newspapers running, you know, lying around. There are no books lying around. I'm just speculating now. And therefore, it raises the question of motivation. You know, are the university students, white and black, motivated to complete their studies? Is it the proper aspiration on their part? And so the question of student motivation, I mean, I'd like a response on that. What is the level of student motivation at universities? And do we understand the background of the student in order to get to grips with that? Because they're already in the system, and it's a horrible waste that you have so many kids who actually are not graduating on time.
Anyone else? Our father of
thank you, Chair. I just wanted to check what is so difficult from the Vice-Chancellor here who has the coolness of this issue that we are discussing. What is the main difficulty in terms of developing and keeping black academics at the institution? Professor Pichana said to that. And I think that it would be a big advance if it were possible to train, develop, and keep as many black academics as possible, because it will help in terms of making students feel at home and sort of tech students. May I just give something anecdotal? When I was still working in Pretoria, I had a contact with a student from the University of Pretoria. He was in engineering. And as we discussed, he had his own financial problems, mainly because the NSFAS pays about two-thirds, but the parents were unable to pay the rest, including accommodation, food, and so on. He was just having lots of problems, but he's just an example of what happens, and this affects the achievement and the performance with the studies. But then he brought other students, and informally we were just talking. They talk about situations where, say, for a professor or a lecturer sees students at a given time or a given day during the week, say Monday or Tuesday or whatever the case might be. And students know that at this time they can go and queue to see their lecturer or professor. And they notice that Afrikaner students take a very long time there with their professor. And they were never insulted. Nobody ever called them names and so on. But they just feel out of place at the university. And it's easy to see why, for example, if an Afrikaner student gets in there, it's handed, you know, in their language. Who's Mensa Baby is, and they talk about rivalries and rugby and how the Bulls performed and so on. These are 19, 18, 20-year-olds. Who's your father? What school did you go to? And, you know, and in their own language. And then go there comes in an African student, and absolutely no relationship. And it's just, good afternoon, how are you? How can I help you? And the 19-year-old, 18-year-old is scared, and this is the problem. And say, you do it like this, like this, like this. Anything else? No. So you go out, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, you're out. If you have more black academics, they will be able to find out who are from Kanduli or from whatever it is, and you talk about the school, about the village in their own language. Let them keep feel at home and relaxed and so on. And then you are able to help them. It is a very useful aspect of interaction with the environment and with your teachers. So what are the issues? Well, is it only pay? I know that the salaries are a big issue. Is that the only thing? Or is it difficult for black academics to stay at those universities as well? If it is for academics who are mature people, how would it be for youngsters who are 18, 19-year-olds at those universities?
Sponsors, and then you can open up.
Chair, can I quickly move on to a very first question about your concern? The impression given is that a transformation will not move, except that there has to be funding all the time. I think that's not what we're saying. If you read the recommendations to the minister, the Sojin report itself talks about funding for nurturing and mentoring black staff members to take up senior level positions, and then it talks about earmarked funds for academic development, it is within that context. Admittedly, we accept that transformation is a change, and we cannot say transformation will not take place without there being funding. We accept that because there is an issue of cultural change and cultural understanding and creating and enabling teaching and learning environment. So that in itself is a transformation change. But of course, in order to put into place the very recommendation which comes here, so that is against that background that we talk about funding. So that's one. But the second one about the student and my colleagues who are coming in, the level of motivation. I think this is, in essence, where student orientation comes in, where that collegiality is being brought in between academics and students, as well as creating an enabling environment for them to feel at home away from home. There are quite a number of practices around that issue. And of course, institutions will differ from one another in creating that kind of environment. But the last point that the Honorable Nguni Mangena raised about developing black academics, I think this is something that we spoke about last night, and I think that the Prof. Jana will come in there as to what it is that institutions are doing.
Honorable Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much. There is no doubt that in our day and age, students come to higher education seemingly for a variety of reasons. It's important to note that the Department of Higher Education and Training is engaged in a real campaign that enables students not to see higher education as the only route to post-school training and education. And we do think that the FET and the vocational sector is an important part of this and needs to be developed very, very rigorously. Maybe the budget that has been passed would go a long way towards establishing this. By the way, we also think that the so-called higher education national institutes in Mpumalanga and Northern Cape should rapidly become universities, because there's just such a major need out there. But it is true that there is in our country, and I'm speaking analytically, though not as a sociologist, in the presence of Honorable James. But what I really want to say is that there is no doubt in my mind that young people of our time are battling a great deal with the whole range of pressures that they have to deal with. And I always remind myself that the environment is vastly different from when Honorable Mangena and I were university students, and the pressures on students today are vastly, vastly different. I always say to colleagues, that really does mean that there is an even added obligation on universities and institutions to create an environment that is enabling to students. And it seems to me that what is happening is that there is probably less of an environment that is affirming
probably more alienating without many institutions being conscious of, in many of our institutions in Manhattan. Because we know that the social environment and pressures are as much as they are, we are getting a very wasteful dropout rate, and indeed of a failure rate in our institutions. Universities can no longer afford, as Honorable Mangena says, can no longer afford to be indifferent to how students are performing, are finding institutions and university life. Academics are also going through enormous pressures, and a lot of pressure is being put on everybody in higher education institutions today. And that is the reason we are saying that we need to try and move away from the pathologizing of higher education institutions and empower and enable institutions in a very fundamental way to really being a theologian, I wanted to say that they must be born again. I think you'll understand. We need higher education institutions in our country to be born again. And the commitment that we have in as higher education institutions is to really make that environment and build that commitment from higher education institutions and working with councils. That's not to say the individual problems are not important, but they need to be dealt with at some level. But there is a greater challenge that we have to face now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll respond to some of the issues that have been raised. I want to agree fully with Honorable Wilmot James in terms of his definition of transformation being really to develop and nurture the potential of our students so that they can become useful citizens of our country. And I also fully agree with him in that there has to be really emphasis on looking at black students or students from disadvantaged communities. But I think he's also making a critical point, and it's something that higher education needs to be supported in. It's motivating those students, particularly students from the black community. I think universities need to set up very strong support systems for students, because unless you have that to support them, not only in class but also outside class, be it in terms of even mentoring systems in residencies, I think this is also a critical point. I think government stopped at some point providing support and subsidy for residencies. And our students, they live in digs that say you can't do any academic work. And hence, I'm glad that part of what has come through in this report is a really rethinking about our approach to creating residencies, because those can become communities of learning for students. So I'm just emphasizing the fact that indeed it's particularly important that we create very strong support systems for our students. And American universities are extremely successful in doing that. And student support systems are very strong in many of the American universities, because that's how you bring about success. The interesting one is the one that's raised by the Honorable Mr. Mangena in raising the fact that why are we failing to get our black academic stay? And this is something I do a lot in terms of discussing with up-and-coming black students. Why are they staying longer, as I said, they can replace us? I think one of the things that we face with is really the first generation university cohort, because those are the ones
who come into university and see it as just a step of getting this so that I can go out there and assist my family. And in fact, this is where universities struggle a lot in trying to keep them, so that you're not supporting just the students in doing other postgraduate work, but in fact, you must keep in mind that you're supporting the associated extended family. So this is where one of the challenges lie. But I think at the moment also, but it's common to anywhere, I think there's a lot of mobility of our, of even our own staff. And therefore some of the assumptions that we tend to make here, and we think universities are these strong units that can do, that can be a panacea for all our ills. I suppose we need to revisit that. And the typical example of that is that on the average, our public universities have an average of about 15% people with doctorates and 35% with masters. I think compare that with an average institution in developed countries where you find that 70% are people with doctorate. So universities don't have the capacity that we think we have. And therefore, for me, what is critical before we do all what we want to achieve, it's also a very focused program to develop our universities to become true universities. Thank you.
I think Mr. Mangena outlined, I mean, very important cultural inhibitions or factors that do not facilitate student development and learning within higher education. Those factors, I think, apply equally to staff, because you find that there aren't critical numbers of black academics, and if black academics normally people have problems of culture that are alienating, because we are a minority in some disciplines which are basically all white, and so that is a big issue. But as a country, do have then a strategy to develop the critical masses of black people in particular fields? Do we have an internationalization program like other countries? Look at Japan. I mean, they're an advanced country, but they train a lot of their scientists abroad in the West. Look at India, the number of Indian students sent by Indian government to other countries to study, and it's an asset, they come back. We look at figures on internationalization. Kenya is doing even much better than South Africa in training the academics abroad. So I think it's a problem that needs a national strategy.
Thanks, Chair. Could I make a few points that pick up on different terms of the conversation? The first, although I'm afraid it's going backwards slightly, I do want to emphasize that the document that was sent and tabled, as several people have said, was a preliminary working document, but it is now publicly available, and I think you asked us not to go through each item, but perhaps to flag two or three items where there's more controversy and disagreement within HESA. I'm not sure if that came across clearly, and if I could just go briefly touch on those. And so I think that the first one is it's recommendation 1.2 of the report, but it's also summarized in the document that's on the screen at the moment. And that one says establishment of a permanent oversight committee to monitoring the transformation of higher education. I think this is a controversial recommendation, and I just want to emphasize that it's not been discussed really yet at HESA. We don't have a position, because the column next to it says that this is within the ambit of the minister, and the HESA would not object to such a thing. I think that reflects an early stage of the discussion. And as you can imagine, this concern arises out of the tension between understanding how accountability of public higher education institutions work towards government, with the questions of autonomy and academic exactly does an oversight committee do? Is it simply that instead of having one official in the department, you have two or three whose heads, you know, the collective thinking is better than one in processing the reports that come up from the higher education institutions? Or is it something more than that? And it's not really spelled out in the recommendation, but I want to flag that as the first issue. If I may then go to the second one, someone working with computers will be able to pull it up more quickly, I think. And that is, it's under section 7.3, and this is a recommendation in the Studeen report, essentially that universities should pay black and female academics or provide what they call support packages, but actually if you read the report they're talking about remuneration packages more than other academics, in other words, more than whites and males. Now, there may be good reasons for this, and there isn't yet a view, but I just wanted to flag this as one of the controversial recommendations, which I think Heath is grappling with. And my guess is that Heath in the end will not take a view on this, that probably individual institutions will say, will take different views and will take a view that if they need to, if they recognize the particular scarcity of senior female academics or black academics, many will be willing to pay more to retain them in academia, recognizing that these same people with their PhDs or with their higher qualifications are in hot demand in government, in industry, in the private sector, and that the only way we're going to be able to, some of us take the view that the only way we're going to be able to transform the demography of senior academics is by paying more and is by offering better conditions of service. We don't have to pay that to all academics because other academics are not in such and necessarily in such hot demand, and we don't have the money to pay everyone much higher salaries. If we did, we would. But it's going to be an issue that I think is going to have quite a lot of debate. The third, as you can see, because by virtue of the fact that I'm skipping over many of these issues, is that we think there is broad agreement with most of the recommendations that have been made. I want to emphasize the issue of residences, which has been highlighted. But the last one, which I think is going to be contested, is around institutional forums, and trying to quickly find where that is. Forgive me. At any rate, in one of the recommendations of the ministry, of the commission, is that the institution fora should be strengthened. Thank you very much. 6.2. And the Commission reflected on the fact that, as everyone knows what the institutional fora are, these are statutory structures which have to have representation of students, of academic staff, and of management, and other staff. The unions are also usually represented. These fora were established at a time, of course, in 1994, and some of them had already been established by institutions before 1994 as part of the transition process. But they were established at a time when the senates of the universities, the councils, were the traditional councils and the traditional structures, largely dominated by white people who had, of course, grown up in those systems. And there was a concern that if you only left the decision-making to those structures, you were simply going to reproduce conservative decision-making. And the fora was an alternative point of power in the institution, which would provide alternative views, and particularly around issues of translation. Now, the commission, the Ministerial Commission, reviewed these and found that many of them are not working very well. Many of them have meetings which for years are never quorate. They can't get people to participate and attend, and they're not making a real good contribution to governance. But the Commission's recommendation is that they must be strengthened. Whereas I think within HESA, there is, and with some institutions, there are questions about whether they shouldn't be abolished, but they still have a role to play. And so I just also want to highlight that the summary report, the summary comment here says agree, but most importantly there needs to be a comment. I think that doesn't necessarily reflect yet the view of it. That was the first point. The second, Chair, thanks for giving me that, is around your role as a portfolio committee in getting feedback on transformation and how you do it. And I suppose one of the things that comes out clearly from the report is that different universities face such different situations, and that HESA can give a sector report, but that will often hide more than it reveals. And that clearly an institution which is historically black faces a very different set of circumstances with respect to transformation of the student body than an institution which is predominantly white. The institutional cultures that Honourable Member Mangena referred to, which are profound in historically white institutions, are probably not nearly as significant, I guess, in other institutions. So I think for the Portfolio Committee to really have its finger on the pulse, it will itself need to look at how individual institutions are doing and look at those reports and invite institutions to report to you and perhaps make visits to institutions to get a feel of what's happening on the ground and not be too reliant on a view of the sector. And I think that's partly what comes out of these things. And then I think the third point I'd like to address is your comment about resources. And to say that I agree with your comment, but there are some areas which we can clearly identify are resource linked, and the residences is one of them. Residences, by and large, are not self-financing because we can't charge students enough to make them viable, and therefore we can only increase residence capacity, which is a very profound transformation intervention because it definitely increases the success rate of students, disadvantaged students in particular. But that is something that will either happen because the government puts money into it or it won't happen because they don't. I don't think that's really about reallocating resources. There are other interventions which I think are much more, which are not about resources primarily, and those are the institutional culture interventions, where I think a range of things, but often related to workshops with staff, talking to staff about pedagogy in a diverse classroom or in a classroom where you have kids who have come from strong schools and come from weak schools. Those are things we can do which do change the culture, and which are not expensive and we should be doing, and I think we are doing it. But perhaps we're not doing enough to share the best practice, and one of the purposes of that transformation forum and the communities of practice that HESA facilitates is to get to share the best practice around those things. And then there's going to be issues which are resource intensive, but where we perhaps seek a lead from government on which choice to make. And here I would focus on the question of academic development programs and support for students to get through. I have no doubt that if we took in fewer students, we would be able to devote more resources to them. For example, if we decided to take in, with the same capacity we had, if we let students take 4 years routinely rather than 2 years for a 3-degree, obviously that means taking in about 25% fewer students because the capacity doesn't otherwise expand to take in students just for an extra year. As the point you made about holding first-year students because they're repeating, well, that means you have a very big first-year class. We could take fewer students, and if we did that, focus resources more on academic development and improve the throughput rate. We have been under significant pressure to increase the numbers of students to absorb more, and this is the point that people made earlier in the discussion, that we have a lot of students coming out of the school system. Where can we put them? But I think many universities, in my view, and this is not a HESA view, in my view, many universities are taking students who shouldn't be at university, and that they are, as a result, that in other words, they're 2 weeks, their school results are 2 weeks. And as a result, we are filling up university places with people, keeping them there much longer than they ought to be, in a sense being very inefficient, as you see with the graduation rate. But that if we were given the support, we need to discuss this, but with support, we might choose to have some fewer students, but to focus the resources and improve the throughput rate and improve the graduation rate with the same resources that we have. If, however, there remains the sort of pressure to increase numbers, then I'm afraid that does have resource implications, both for throughput and for increasing the numbers. A last point I think is about retaining senior black staff and women academics. I think there are two parts to this problem. One is that we lose them to competitive sectors, and there's not a lot we can do that about that except ultimately to pay more, and paying more would require more resources, and I think the universities generally don't have that. But the other is to recognize that there is an inevitable lag between, to become a professor is something that happens sort of 20 to 25 years after you start studying or after you finish studying perhaps. And so to accelerate that, or to expect that the professoriate would have changed significantly is unrealistic, just because not enough time has passed. One first fixes the school systems. We do have many more black students coming through with postgraduate degrees now than we did 10 years ago. If you look at those figures, you'll see significant improvement. If you look at the proportion of junior lecturers who are black, very significant improvement. So I think we are seeing real change, but the professoriate hasn't changed, and that's because it will change in 10 to 15 years' time. Now, therefore, what interventions do we have to facilitate that? Well, I think the only thing we have is to accelerate that from junior lecturer to professor. And we can accelerate that by putting resources into, for example, giving people more frequent sabbaticals, buying them out of their teaching time instead of waiting 6 years. They could come out after 3 years and have time to promote, to improve their research, reducing their teaching loads, which is difficult given the numbers, give mentorship programs, additional dedicated programs that promote writing skills, research skills. And I think that that's where a lot of our intervention, our focus should be in order to increase the number of blacks in senior leadership positions in universities. Well, I mean in senior academic positions. Leadership, of course, is to some extent taken care of. Of the 23 universities, I think only two do not have black vice chancellors. So, I mean, I think in the leadership, we're actually doing much better.
Thank you, Dr. Pryor. I'm noting hands. I just want to indirect response to this issue about this autonomy and all of those things in relation to that first point. I am asking myself how much autonomy we require on the common objectives on transformation. That's a very serious issue that I want to pull up. So if we are, in the context of the implementation, I think it relates to that oversight committee. We understand the bigger debate of freedom of speech, autonomy, etc. But do we actually require autonomy for every university and every institution in the society to decide how they're going to implement and impact on transformation? It's something that I'm posing and I'm throwing out. Doesn't mean I'm right. The second issue is I think you're also right, the point around the best practice, the research resource for transformation at times or not. Before you entered, I indicated in the beginning that we've actually visited one or two institutions. And we spelled out some of the dilemmas that we've picked up. So that will happen. That will happen. The concern really is, if we are doing just what we are doing, and we're analyzing these problems as we're analyzing them. Now, we've met Nathan now, and we've met you 6 months ago, I think in August, September. The debate hasn't shifted. So there is an urgency here in society through the roadmap to education. There is an urgency in society through all the political parties saying this needs to happen. Not necessarily it might happen this way, but let's make education the central focus. And we are having all this debate. And guess what? What you said now, and what you said 6 months ago, and what you said 2 years ago, where I'm sitting is very similar. What Enet Fuss has said now, and what they said 2 years ago, is actually very similar. What the department, in fact, not higher education and training in this case, but the old department in its totality, I've heard that not so long ago they actually gave a position that they don't want teacher assistants in this country. I'm raising it because I'll be raising it. Because if you have teacher assistants,
you know, that we actually get somebody that is not necessarily a teacher, but help the teacher in the classroom, you know, with the groups and the breakouts and do the support. Now, I'm trying to understand. Now, I've got it in very good authority, to somebody senior in the education department. Now, what are we doing? Why are we having a situation that we're all saying that this is where we must go, but the practice, and then back to Member Hadevi, the year of action and its implementation on obvious issues is not happening. Because some of those things just need coherence, needs coordination, needs pulling together. The provincial governments of the various provinces, they are putting money for bursaries. What's the talk between what they are doing and what you are doing? I'm saying that's the bigger issue. Yeah, Professor. That for me somewhat is the way the state currently is positioned to intervene on what we are saying needs to be corrected. And I'm not so sure if we are appropriately positioned for that. So I'm leaving that one in. The other thing that bothers me is 9.5, unless I'm completely stupid. What does this mean? 9.5, choosing resident managers on the basis of this. No, it's not my document. I'm asking the question that it's actually in, that it's there, that it's a recommendation. So I'm saying I'm most probably very stupid. I don't understand what this means. Because if it is what I think it means, it is a serious issue. And especially we get the recommend or the response from that, you know, just a response, we should just possibly do that once in a while, if that is what I think it is. But I'll park that there. Read the implementation and Dr.
Thank you, Chair. So that we are not where the Chair says we've always been 5 years ago. Professor Chobeka, last year, when you came, I asked the question and you promised. I asked you about the measures and how they are and have been performing and whether the reason for their formation has achieved the objectives. And I remember that you then said something about it wouldn't be good to de-emerge because there are lessons there. So I just want to understand, against the background of everything else that we have as challenges and things, where is the measure process in terms of, I was hoping that some of the challenges would have been taken care of by the measure. I do not know. So that was my hope. So that's number one. Somewhere I seem to remember that you said that there would be a process of evaluating the measure somewhere. So I don't know where that process is and whether they have the objective itself for merging. I do have my own impressions. But that does not mean that's what is happening. Thank you, Chair. So, secondly, Chair, speaking of transformation, I promise you this is my last. Speaking of transformation, and speaking of this report, as Professor Zide has just taken us through, and just looking at the report and looking at the responses to the student report, how do we transform, I'm talking about the voices I was speaking about earlier, how do we transform these two voices of the Sudin report and HISA? How do we transform the Sudin report from an appraisal voice and a recommending voice? How do we transform the HISA voice from a responding voice to a common voice that seeks a common solution? Because here, I see a report that says, I agree. I don't agree. Well, that's your prerogative. It's not mine. I'm already doing it. So what? You know. So this is what is happening here. So disengagement. So I'm just saying, Che, and our, my colleagues here, to say that maybe us as the portfolio committee, we need to facilitate the meeting of these voices so that we more talk about partnership in this voice. Because if HISA and the institutions feel that they were subjects of, in other words, they were being appraised in terms of where they are and all of that, how do we transform that into an engagement process so that we have a partnering of these voices to the extent that next year this time we're saying something better than we have been saying all along? Thank you.
I'm hearing now from the commission,
and then I want to get the response, and then I'm going to close this part of our meeting.
I think you're right in the sense that we've been debating this question of the future of the higher education sector, and we actually haven't gotten very far. I mean, I think, and that's partly because some of us are not listening hard enough to what people are saying, and it might be a whole range of other reasons, but I actually think it's quite unproductive to simply say, look, we're not getting anywhere. The question is, where do we go from here, and how do we get there through thinking through the issues in a very organized, disciplined, and rigorous manner, because past solutions is not an answer. If I can just indulge you for a second, since I have all the ESA people here, and I'm going to pretend to be an economist, and I'm going to pretend I'm looking at a sector, and I need great efficiencies out of that sector. The first thing I would do is measure the output. That is, I would want to see what the quality is of the, I hate this language, but the quality of the student. How do I measure that? I measure it by actually conducting an independent survey to see whether that student has grasped the field for which he or she has graduated. And it's not just language ability, it's also about an ability to grasp the basics of engineering. And I can test those students across the sector. The second thing I would want to know is which institutions are operating better, functioning better than others. And I can identify those. And as an economist, what I would then do is decide what I do with underperforming institutions. If I'm running BMW, I would shut those plants down. I actually would do that. And I would take the money and give it to the functioning institutions. If I was to apply that logic in a cold way to the higher education sector, I would shut down all the underperforming universities, take that budget and give it to the functioning universities, and possibly only give the other half to private sector initiatives. Because I think the higher education sector needs a bit of competition, in fact. And a competitive dynamic to it would, you know, in terms of how markets operate, would push up the quality, both in terms of how many students they attract and so on. And I just want to throw it out. I think there's a smugness in the sector, and I don't mean it in a pejorative sense, because state funding comes. Well, right now, just given the recession, given the allocation of the budget, there is no more money. And so the question is, how do you get some competition into the sector? How can you get the university sector to attract more private money into it, corporate support, around joint projects and so on? Thank you.
I'm going to get responses, and then you're concluding. But before that, the last member.
Well, thanks, Chair. I just wanted to also, I mean, it's unfortunately Professor Pichan has just left. I wanted to also ask whether they're going to be able to speed up the process of the establishment of these universities in these provinces that doesn't have universities. Are they going to assist in terms of pushing up that establishment of these universities? Because as you just given us the statistic that there's a shortage of universities in terms of the capacity, I think also the expansion of these two universities can be able to assist in putting more of that capacity. But the other issue is related to the student learner support, in your 8.1. there is somewhere where there's sort of an articulation to say you're going to be able to provide the support to the field where there's a shortage of skills. But also I would like to add up to say maybe you should be able to put up a database, a tracker to these children, because when we have these dropout of our students, you must be able to check what are the challenges, because you might be able to, you might also find yourself losing credible students that are also performing very well, but because of the financial support or other support that they're also getting. So you must be able to also maybe sort of put a sort of a tracker support, so that when you lose some of these children, we can be able at least to detect, but also to be able to produce to South Africa to say, after that far, as the new democracy has came into our part, this is what we have produced. We've got this number of engineers, we've got number of accountants, we've got number of, so that you can be able to produce a tangible number, a specific, so that you can be able to, you can't just say we produce engineers, but where are they? How many are they? You can't have those databases. I think it's one of the other issues that you can be able to also do. But also, in your 9.3, in terms of the, you know, I can see that you want to review the election structure. I just need to get a clarity. Are you talking about the election structure in relation to the elections of the SRCs? Because as you're going to review the structure, but you must also have particular systems that you can be able to orientate these student organizations, so that you won't find student organizations fighting one another, instead in the process of lecture along the process, because you must be able to also find center and they must find common ground, irrespective either one wins, either one loses, so that you don't find people, instead of studying in classes, they will find themselves walking out. Thank you.
I have a copy of it. May I read it to you in the original report? I don't know if the department has a copy. Because I think it's not as controversial, which is why that's a sort of very shorthand. 9.5 recommendation says as follows. It's actually 9.6, in the report. It's not even 9.3. In some institutions, it appears that residence managers were chosen on ethnic grounds. It is recommended that institutional employment equity plans be applied to residence employees so as to ensure that the composition of residence managers is demographically representative. That was the recommendation, and I think our response is that that's perfectly right. That's what we were pointing to. Yeah, but that's a very shorthand for this recommendation.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the comments that were made by the last honorable member. And one of the issues he raised is about the establishment of new universities. Let me quickly say that, in fact, the boards of the National Institute for Higher Education, part of their mandate is really to make recommendations to the minister about the future of higher education in those respective provinces. And I'm part of the board in Mpumalanga, and one of the things we will soon be making is really giving to the minister various scenarios that can evolve within that process. There's another poll. No, I appreciate it. Then let's go to some of the issues that were raised. I think our honorable member is taking me to account for measures there. So I'm going to do that immediately. Our own sense, indeed, the measures to a large extent have achieved part of what they were intended for, from really moving us from diversity within our university sector, such that universities are much more better placed in order to really supply the various skills to our economy. So I think for that, from that point of view, yes, that was transformation at his best. I'm not saying some of the issues have been totally addressed. I think some of the challenges that are still there within the institutions that have emerged, it's really issues of ensuring that, you know, you've got equity in terms of infrastructure across universities. So I don't want to emphasize the money factor, but it is a reality because where you brought together previously disadvantaged and, you know, an advantaged institution, there are differences in levels of provisioning that existed, and therefore creating an equitable situation remains still a challenge, but institutions are working through this. And let me also say that we've received quite a fair amount of resources towards infrastructural development, but it can never be sufficient. So there are still challenges, but it was not just about really reorganizing structures, etc. I think at the center of it, it's about the quality of what these new institutions are doing. And indeed, they are working hard at improving not only the quality, but the efficiency. That still remains a challenge. I must admit that. The second issue that I need to respond to. Yes, indeed, the process we had said, we ourselves as merged universities, we would take ourselves through, was setting up a national conference on mergers where we were going to kind of get a mid-term evaluation of where these things were. And that conference did take place in October last year. And indeed, I must say that I think merged universities are not doing well in terms of informing the public about what has happened in those institutions. I think, so in that sense, they are an enemy to themselves because so many things, there's been quite great development in those universities. And on the whole, we came out from that conference with a positive outlook, and there was a lot of sharing of experience amongst the universities. But this doesn't say that there are some of the measures that perhaps are not where one would be expecting them to be. So that would be my quick response to the issue of measures. Transformation reported two voices. I think maybe the portfolio committee is hearing these two voices. But we as higher education, and perhaps probably this is how we've always operated, we open to various views. And in fact, we don't see this as perhaps a voice that criticizes us negatively. And therefore, what we're doing as ISA, as well as individual institutions, we're looking at this report, and in a very constructive way, because we really believe that transformation is key to our university, all forms of transformation, particularly the Honorable James Willmott's definition of transformation is going to be key. So in that sense, all of us, we have a kind of shared understanding. And therefore, the issue that as we come here, we're coming to say, what are those things that seem to have emerged from the report that we can take together in a much more constructive way and move forward in terms of our transformation trajectory? So for us, the two voices are not so much outstanding. I fully understand your time constraint. But I want also to just quickly say that for us also, we think these kinds of engagements are part of building really consensus around the whole transformation trajectory. Let me conclude by saying that I appreciate the economics approach to managing performance of university, kills those that are not performing, and perhaps I would temper with it slightly. Those that are not performing as expected, provide them great support, because I think the country as a developing country needs much more support than the kind of cruel kill and approach that one would easily fall into.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. let me thank Professor for that, particular to that, but the just the analysis on most problems. It's important that we continue to engage on this. Let me say, members, that we in fact gave recommendations, Honourable Member James, 6-7 months ago, including the recommendation of the profiling that Honourable Member Khadebe raised. The point is, it seems there's inaction at the level of the institution dealing with education. So a question that I would pose to the committee is, when we do say, so whether you call it a survey, whether you call it a database, whether you call it analysis, it's there. It's in the recommendations of this committee a while ago. Because we do believe, not necessarily on identifying the problem, so that's what we do, but to say, how do we then step up in terms of immediate over the next 10 years, and then obviously long term? I also want to say that it would be of concern if because you see the BMW example, Member Chain, you have the rollout of these BMWs, and they have the branches and all of that, and broadly the tires is there, the fuel is there, the this is there, and all of that. And hence, when a capacity problem emerges or not, the movement forward, you can clinically deal with that. We are having a situation where we're dealing with institutions that were across this country, and institutions that, in a sense, had particular funding arrangements historically. And therefore, there is a realignment in all of that. And the entity is, how do we capacitate, how do we strengthen, but also how do we deal with management issues. But the support mechanism to our students, because it is developmental in a very true nature, but developmental therefore doesn't mean we can't have the quality. We can have the quality. See, the issue around the funding and all the money, etc., and the resources, The report of DBSA analyzed that across SADC, we are spending most of our money into schooling, support, and infrastructure. But the quality that we're getting out, so this notion of the infrastructure spend is fine, the residences, etc. I'm concerned that we are throwing the issue of the money always up front. Now, I was in countries where I said, quality outcome, but real situations in South Africa in terms of both universities and schools. So it's this thing of how do we change the tanker, and that is what I'm not clear about, what I'm picking up. Can we agree that we'll come back, the issue of mergers, we in fact in our program, first up, we've got, I think for next week, a visit to the University of Technology in Cape Town. And one of the items to be discussed is the implications, positive, negative, and, you know, the impact, broad impact, on the merger. Now, I think what we should do after this discussion and whilst you've raised it, is we also should get a strategic presentation, not only around the University of Technology, etc., but that will come from the department. So we'll make sure that we, because merger is on the agenda for that university, but I think we should just lift it up into its strategic nature across the country as well. Then we are heading towards the Human Rights Day. And my advice would be that we actually get a strategic
engagement going. Not where there's 200 people in the room, but possibly the key decision makers on you call it, because I could hear you. This is the report. And then this is Hester. Not only responses, but their own analysis about transformation. And how do we find them coherent? But how do we get better throughput? What is the action? Because we can quickly get people to write research documents. But I'm not interested really anymore in research documents on throughput, bettering throughput. Because I think it's practicalities. So in 2010, in end of 2010, can we put up a better target in South Africa for throughput when it comes to the scarce skill environment? That's both IT and obviously engineering and digital skills, as an example. And what therefore do we need to deal with today to the number of individuals that study in that field? What must every university do to give support? What is the funding problem? Not the funding in its funding broad problem, but what's practically to make sure that we support them, the students, because it's not every student that needs support, but it's most of them. And can we then provide mechanisms? Is there money somewhere else which does provide support at times for this motivational support, support to the students, and other related support mechanisms? And then implement on that. So I'm suggesting that what we will do and engage is possibly in over the next month or two to have a strategic discussion, but NSFAS will be there. Higher Education South Africa and a few relevant structures will be there to look at the practicality of that process, so that we don't sit again with just getting reports that doesn't really take us anywhere. And then I'll just ask the members, we need to leave here at 12:30, so we've got 15 minutes left, so that we don't break now, that we then just deal quickly with the remainder. Thank you. Thank you, members of Higher Education South Africa.
We would like to thank the Portfolio Committee for having hosted us, and we hope we will have these future engagements. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.